Howdy, I'm back. This is episode 6 in my series on Germanic medieval cultural history. Don't forget the email here is tom.casualt@gmail.com. That's tom.casualt@gmail.com. I was very pleased. I got a good review from a guy named Ann, that is, and his blog is called Ann is a Man. It's a very friendly review. I was happy about it. So anyway, I thought I'd also note before we get into things that I decided to scrap the idea of intro music. I want to keep this minimalistic, no bells and whistles, because I'm a fundamentally lazy person. But a funny anecdote: the day after I recorded that podcast where I used that old punk band Nausea as the intro music, I saw someone at the Minneapolis Farmers Market with a Nausea shirt on. It's surprising because I didn't think anyone listened to that anymore because nobody should listen to that anymore. Anyway, this time we'll be talking about Iceland. Now, keep in mind, we're still discussing prehistorical German culture. So why talk about Iceland? It's nowhere near Germany, and it was settled in historical times. But it's from Iceland that we have the bulk of Nordic mythological literature. And even if these myths were put to parchment in the 13th century, which is long after Germans or most anyone else ceased to adhere to explicitly pagan practices, at least some of the information given by Icelandic authors corroborates information we have about the ancient Germanic tribes, and presumably a lot of the stuff that is only found in Iceland reflects general Germanic practice to one degree or another. But before we get into Icelandic literature, we should have a brief introduction to the island and its place in history. It's an odd case, Iceland is, in history. It was settled in during the Viking Age, and there was pretty much nobody there when the Vikings started arriving. There were apparently some Irish monks settled there, but they left of their own accord because they didn't want to live among heathens. And actually, given the sorts of boats Irish monks were wont to ride around in, it's something of a miracle that they made it to Iceland in the first place, and if they made it back to Ireland, or anywhere else, then they got lucky twice. But Viking ships are famously seaworthy, or were say famously seaworthy, so travel between Norway, Iceland, and the British Isles was relatively secure for the Scandinavians. Relatively. So modern Icelanders are actually in a unique historical position. They can say in all honesty that their ancestors didn't kill, enslave, or otherwise dominate a native population in order to settle the island. Now, the Icelanders spent the better part of the Middle Ages murdering each other, and things didn't work out that way because Vikings were opposed to killing people and taking their stuff. Killing people and taking their stuff is part of the job description of being a Viking. But settlers were attracted to Iceland because it was out of the way, offered free land, and you didn't need to worry about native populations like you might if you were in Ireland or Rus, some other places that Vikings put settlements down. So, since nobody was there when Scandinavians started showing up, with the exception of a handful of Irish holy men, the sort of society that was built there was, I don't want to say egalitarian, but there was no king, no generalissimo, nor duke of Iceland, and the state was minimal. It was something of a libertarian paradise, which is why people got killed all the time. But justice was by self-help, and that's not to say that there were no laws. Iceland had plenty of laws in a collection known as Gragas, actually, that is Grey Goose. And legislation was decided at the Althing. And I mentioned in an earlier podcast that the old Germanic method of governance goes back to these conferences of all freeborn men that Tacitus mentions. So we can see that the sort of society built here is in some ways similar to what existed in prehistoric Germany. That is, a clan-based society in which scattered settlements that are organized around family connections are these settlements are the basic economic producers, and they're sort of centered around a paterfamilias. So, concerning the law, let's say you have some sort of dispute with your neighbor And you'll find plenty of examples of this sort of dispute in the sagas. If it hasn't already come to blows, which is unlikely, you can take it to the Althing and adjudicate it there, and maybe some sort of decision can be come to. But if it's something that involved the loss of life, then the Althing will have to determine, that is, when it's judged, will have to determine if anyone or who should end up getting outlawed. And if somebody finds themselves outlawed, that means they are no longer legally protected, and anyone can kill them and expect not to provoke further blood feud. So, well, that's not really how it usually worked out. But anyway, outlawry was in effect a death sentence if the guilty party didn't manage to get out of Iceland for the duration of the outlawry. And that's actually quite common, that if you get outlawed, then you go to Norway, you maybe go to Europe, and find something to do there. But there are a couple of famous outlaws who managed to live for a good amount of time as outlaws. Maybe the most famous is Grettir of Grettir's Saga, and he lived a rather long life as an outlaw. And actually, Grettir is interesting for other reasons, and we might come back to him later. One of the most significant events in Icelandic history was, of course, the acceptance of Christianity by an act of the Althing. And this happened in a year that's mercifully easy to remember, the year 1000. So, and that doesn't mean that in the year 1000 everyone suddenly became deeply believing Christians, though certainly there are already some heartfelt Christians among the Icelanders. The worship of the old gods went on for some time in private, and unlike in other places, there was really no method of enforcement. There's no way to coerce people into Christian practice. I mean, you had your private homestead, and there's no state apparatus to peer into your household and see whether you're sacrificing to Thor or praying to Christ. So, well, at any rate, by the 12th and 13th centuries, Iceland had pretty much become Christian. And in fact, in Grettir's Saga, it's rather interesting. There's a fellow named Glam, Grettir's Saga was written in the 13th century, but it's, of course, about an earlier time, just not too long after the Christianization. And Glam is sort of pro-heathen, and he ends up getting killed for that. So, and by the 13th century, you can say that Iceland is quite Christian. And, of course, by this time, of course, Christianity brings literacy, and Iceland had produced some very educated people. And we'll be concentrating now on only one fellow, a guy named Snorri Sturluson. And the reason we'll be concentrating on Snorri is because he is the person who produced most of our mythological literature. He composed the Younger Edda, as well as the Ynglingasaga, and probably Eagle's Saga as well, which is one of the more famous hero sagas. Besides an author, he was also a politician, and unfortunately a rather sleazy politician. I say unfortunately because he's such a valuable author. Nobody likes to enjoy the works of a particular person and find out that the person behind those works was less than ethical. What Snorri mainly has going against him was his attempt to sell Iceland out to the Norwegian crown. He was buddies with the Norwegian king, and when he became the law speaker of the Althing, that's a certain, the high office of the Althing, and this law speaker has, the reason he's called the law speaker is because he has to recite the law from memory each year. When Snorri was law speaker, he attempted to vote Iceland into union with Norway. All that aside, though, Snorri was very interested in history, and that's his focus in Ynglingasaga, which deals with the kings of Norway. And he starts off, actually, with the story of the gods. His idea is that the gods had been historical peoples. It's a euhemeristic idea. I think I've mentioned euhemerist before. He's an Alexandrian scholar who put forth a theory like Snorri's that the Greek gods had originally been great kings, and very powerful kings, who were worshipped as gods. And that's Snorri's idea about the Norse gods as well. He locates the origins of these men in Asia, because the Norse name for one group of gods, or deities, is Aesir. which has nothing to do with the word Asia, but coincidentally sounds similar. And he even, it's a whole separate sort of set of ideas or way of thinking that's imported from Europe. But he also, for instance, he identifies Troy with Asgard, which is near the home of the gods. And we'll actually begin into this idea that certain peoples besides the Romans were descended from Troy, certain European peoples. That'll come up later in future podcasts. But Snorri appropriates that idea also for his euhemeristic view of the Norse deities. Anyway, it's from these documents by Snorri that we have the most explanatory information about the Norse gods. As I've said before, the word god can be difficult when you discuss pagan deities because it carries so much Christian baggage, and it entails omnipotence, omniscience, in general a sort of totality of being that isn't really present in the conceptual framework of paganism. Most divine beings are either representative of the dead or of natural forces, neither of which are all-consuming in their knowledge or power. There is also much more diversity in the sorts of supernatural creatures, and while some are more powerful than others, there isn't a strict hierarchical chain of command like you have in Christianity, where God is on top, various sorts of angels are below him, then come men, and of course women below men, and then animals below that. So, and more divine beings immortal in Germanic religion. In Greek religion, the primary differentiator between deities and humans is that between Thanatos and Athanatos, the dying and the undying. Germanic deities have a very long life, but they will die as well at the end of the world when they do battle with what, for now, I'll just call representatives of chaos. And by the way, they lose, or at least they all fight to the death. And fire consumes the world and everyone dies, except for... the bright point is that actually not everyone dies. Two humans survive to repopulate the earth. So in general, it could be said that the Germanic peoples had a sort of cyclical view, alternation between chaos and order. Anyway, it's impossible for me in this format to give a comprehensive look at the works of Snorri and explore the fullness of Germanic mythology, so I encourage you to read the Edda and Ynglingasaga in particular, if you're interested, because I don't have time to talk about the literary merits of the work. But, Gylfaginning, for instance, which is the introductory part of Edda, is really cleverly arranged, and it's worth a read. As, of course, is Skaldskaparmal, which is the middle part in Hattatal, but I like Gylfaginning a lot, which means the tricking of Gylfi. Anyway, for now, I'll just give a partial look at the divine world and introduce the members of the Germanic pantheon. The deities we're talking about can be divided into two basic families. There's the Vanir and the Æsir, whom we've already met to one degree or another. The Vanir tend to be deities of fertility, while the Æsir tend to have more to do with war. The story is that the Vanir and Æsir at one point were at war with one another, but eventually came to a truce, and married each members off to each other, and brought a certain balance to the universe. The Æsir are the more famous, and of course reside in their home, known as Asgard. The chief of the Æsir is Odin. Snorri identifies him with All-Father, is the word he uses, the father of all the gods, and this is probably Snorri's Christian interpretation of things, because even if Odin were the most powerful god, there isn't any evidence that he was really all-powerful. That doesn't seem really likely to me, at least. He's primarily a god of death, that is, a god of fallen warriors whose souls he collects during battles. Or actually, he doesn't collect the souls. His Valkyries collect the souls. And a Valkyrie basically, in effect, means a chooser of the fallen. Val is fall. And the second part, Kuri, is related to our word choose, actually. It's directly related. The Z sound that we have at the end of choose is roticized in Norse, so you get the R sound at the end. But it's in effect the same. There's a German word, Kiesen, or Middle High German word. I don't think it's in modern German. But except for the participle, erkoren, is in modern German. But in Middle High German and Old High German, there's Kiesen, which is our word choose, and that's where we get this word, the choosers of the fallen, the Valkyrie. And he takes these souls back to Valhall, which again literally means the hall of the fallen, or the hall of the slain. And these warriors wait in Valhall until the end of the world, when they will fight alongside Odin. So with Snorri, you get something of a universalization of Odin, because he has numerous names that are listed off, and his multiple names are explained as a result of so many nations needing to worship him, and they all have different names for him, but all the names that Snorri gives are actually Norse, but I guess Snorri doesn't care about that. Odin is also a god of poetry, and how he came to be so has to do with the truce between the Vanir and the Aesir. These two groups had set up a peace conference, and for whatever reason, they sealed the truce by all spitting into a vat, which has some sort of, I suppose, ritualistic value. Afterwards, you know, mixing of fluids. Afterwards, they made a man out of the vat named Kvasir, and this man turned out to be the most intelligent man in the world who could answer any question. And eventually, Kvasir visits some dwarves, and they kill him. They mix his blood with honey and make mead out of it. And if anyone drinks this mead, they'll become a wise man and a poet. And the dwarves eventually get killed too, and the mead is in the possession of a fellow named Suttung. Odin tried to get the mead by working for Suttung's brother, but Suttung wouldn't give him any. So Odin bores into a mountain in the form of a snake, where the mead is kept, and drinks it up over 3 nights. Then he transforms himself into an eagle and flies off to Asgard. And Suttung turns into an eagle as well and gives chase. And as the story goes, when Odin gets close enough to home, his fellow Aesir put out vats where he can spit the mead up, which he does, but Suttung almost gets him. He almost catches up, and it's such a close call that Odin gets frightened, and, let's put it, you know, some of the mead comes out of his backside, so to speak. So if a poet drinks Odin's mead, this the blood of Kvasir, ultimately, then he becomes a poet and a wise man, because Odin is a god of poetry and wisdom. But if he drinks the mead that came out the other end, he becomes a bad poet. And that's the origin of bad poetry. So, the second most important deity is Thor. And there, I would say actually in the past, Thor was probably equal, or maybe even more important than Odin. He's more of an explicit god of strength, and whereas Odin isn't. I mean, presumably Odin can hold his own in a fight as well, but his strength isn't an overt characteristic. His overt characteristics are wisdom and wisdom and magic, whereas Thor is kind of big and dumb. He drives a chariot pulled by goats. And his power comes from 3 magical objects that he possesses. If you've read the comic book, you know what those are. And the most, you know, that is the hammer. And he has a belt that doubles his strength and a pair of iron gloves that he needs to hold his hammer. And his primary occupation is killing giants. That's what he does. And while Odin is wise and powerful, his physical strength isn't overt. Thor, on the other hand, is an epitome of thoughtless violence. He's pretty easy to trick. And as far as the Aesir go, he's the god about whom really some of the funniest stories are told. And for instance, at one point he has to go to the land of the giants dressed up as a bride. And there's another story in which he travels to the fortress of Utgarth and Loki, who tricks him in numerous ways. It's really quite entertaining. And as I said, I suggest you read all this to get more of it. It's really great stuff. So, so to go on, among the male Aesir, the men, the male gods, Balder is the last of the very important ones. He's the most beautiful of the gods, and most beloved. And I've mentioned in a past podcast that Balder is probably descended from the Phoenician god Baal that the Germanic peoples somehow picked up through contact with Carthage. It's not only the similarity of names, but Balder, like Bald, Baal, not Baal, Baal, and other Mediterranean deities is a dying god. Balder was the best loved of all the gods, and for this reason, Frigg took oaths from everything in the universe that Balder would remain unharmed. So iron, stone, animals, diseases, they all promised not to harm Balder. But Frigg doesn't bother taking an oath from Mistletoe. So anyway, it's great fun. So Balder's basically invulnerable, and it's great fun for Balder to let everyone take shots at him for this reason. So one day everyone is throwing stuff at Balder and nothing's hurting him. They throw rocks at him, it doesn't hurt. They throw knives at him, it doesn't hurt. And along comes Loki, and you've probably heard of Loki. He's the trickster god. And he's not very happy about Balder being such a popular guy. So he puts a rod of mistletoe in the hands of Hoth, who's a blind god, or an Aas, and directs him towards Balder. And so the mistletoe strikes Balder, and he dies. This takes place in a sanctuary, so the gods can't take vengeance immediately on Loki. But eventually they get a hold of him and tie him up in a cave with a viper suspended over his face so that poison intermittently falls on Loki's on his forehead. And that's his torture until he manages to get loose. That's the end of the world. So Loki stays there until the end of the world. And he's only released in order to assist with the chaos of Ragnarok. Loki is an important figure as well. He's this famous trickster god of the Norse. But in his case, god is an even less appropriate name because he's actually a giant. It just so happens, however, that he's a blood brother to Odin. And I tend to think of the relationship between Loki and Odin as somewhat analogous to that between God and Satan in the Book of Job. You may remember how in that book, Satan and Jehovah seem to be on rather friendly terms, but nevertheless at cross purposes. So, and the friendship between Odin and Loki is similar in that up to a point, Odin tolerates Loki, and they do a lot of things together, but until of course, Loki has a hand in the death of Balder. Loki is the most important as the father of the three elements of chaos that bring about Ragnarok, which is the end of the world. That is the Midgard serpent, the Fenris wolf, and Muspeli. Among the Vanir, maybe the most important is called Njord, who was given as a hostage to the Aesir and raised among them. So he's by origin a Vanir, but he's lived among the Aesir all his life. And he's a sea god. He's most important for being the father of Freyr and Freya. Freyr is a god of rain, while Freya, curiously, though she is descended from a Vanir, is also a keeper of the dead. She gets half the souls from a battle, so she splits them with Odin whenever there's a battle. Freya seems to be sort of a double of Frigg. Both are married to somewhat similar gods. Frigg is the wife of Odin, of course. And as it turns out, Freya married a god called Odr, or in English often rendered as Odd. And we don't know much about Odr, except that Snorri says he took off to travel the world and pretty much disappeared. But his name is sort of the same as Odin's, or at least the root is the same. The only difference is that Odin has this Na suffix that I talked about earlier. I guess what's going on here is that Snorri knew that there were these two names for basically the same divine concept and didn't really know what to do with both of them, so he disappears one of them, sends him off to, travel the world, because he just doesn't, how can you have two? That would be my guess, at least. So, Freya seems to also be a doublet of Frigg, and while you can't really have two all-fathers like Odin and Odr, he does seem to manage to... So there seems to be some, room for two fertility goddesses in a way, because Frigg is sort of the matron goddess. She's, the wife of Odin, the proper matron goddess. Whereas Freya is kind of, she's the goddess of love, really. She's the Aphrodite of the North. And in a sense, she's kind of a slut, too. I mean, I don't mean to be rude about it, but she'll sleep with anything. Even giants, it's disgusting. So, and Okay, but anyway, going on. Freya is the chief goddess of the so-called Asynjur, who are really just a list of... This is just a list of names. Snorri says very little about them. But we know they existed and were worshipped. I mentioned in an earlier podcast how sometimes you can have deities like Hestia in the Greek tradition. And Hestia is quite important as an object of daily religious devotion. But she doesn't really have a story. And that's probably the case with these Asynjur as well. They may have been fairly important in terms of religion, but didn't have much in the way of personal stories. One of the more interesting, I guess not so much mythologically, but from a historical perspective, is the As called Tyr. And I mentioned at one point earlier that Tyr is the etymological correspondent to Zeus and Jupiter. He is definitely a war god. As Snorri puts it, he isn't the god people pray to when they want to come to a truce. As the epitome of bravery, he was the only one of the gods with the guts to feed the Fenris wolf as a cub. And then later, the Aesir want to bind the wolf, and he can break all sorts of chains. So they find this magic thread, which looks like it'll be very easy to break. And so they kind of, you know, taunt the wolf and say, well, if you're so tough, can you break out of this thread? And the Fenris wolf, not being completely stupid, says, well, okay, I'll give it a shot as long as you give me a guarantee. One of you has to put a hand in my mouth while I try this. And Tyr volunteers because he's so brave, but the Fenris wolf couldn't get out of the magic bindings, and so the Fenris wolf bit off Tyr's hand. And, well, that's how Tyr lost his hand. That's why he's the one-handed god. And that's how the Fenris wolf, which will devour the sun at the end of the world, was bound. Apparently, the Aesir thought this whole process to be rather funny, but Tyr was a little upset about it. But Tyr is also just a name for god. His name is found in a lot of kennings. Kennings are poetic circumlocutions. For instance, we'll just give an example. The most famous is probably Hangatyr, which is actually refers to Odin, even though it has the name of Tyr in it, because it just means god of the hanged. And Odin is god of the hanged, people who are hanged. If you remember from history, when the Vikings are outside of Paris, they defeat this army, and they take the prisoners of war and hang all of them from trees to freak out the enemy, to the Franks. And it works. The Franks pay them to go away. Of course, you pay them 1 year and they're back the next. So Odin is the god of the hanged, so can be called Hangatyr, and that's a kenning, a way of referring to Odin without using the name Odin. Anyway, there are a couple of other A's here, but I think I'll leave it off here. As I said, these are the gods of the Nordic peoples. Many of the gods were certainly shared with German counterparts in older times, and of course that's the whole point of talking about this, is that presumably these gods were worshipped by the ancestors of the Germans. But by the time of Snorri, nobody in Germany worshipped them anymore, except in one respect. Woden and his wife Frigg lived on as folk deities who lead something called the Wild Hunt, and they were in effect demons. But Frigg particularly becomes one of the, what are called the Spinnstubenfrauen, one of the mistresses of the spinning room, like Frau Hola and Berta. But that's a subject for a later podcast. Some of the Norse mythology, or the Germanic mythology, does live on in folklore. Anyway, this wraps up the prehistoric section of this series. Next time we'll move on to Germany in history. I'll briefly move over the foundation of the Merovingian kingdom and the transition of power from the Merovingians to the Carolingians, and talk about what distinguishes German at this point, because up to now we've been talking about the Germanic, and the Germanic won't leave us, but really from here on out we'll be talking about German and Germany as well. And German is basically a linguistic distinction at this point, not a political distinction. But nevertheless, at the time of Charlemagne, and even earlier, it is possible to talk about not Germany so much, but you can talk about German, as opposed to the Germanic ancestors of German, So, coming up next time. And wrap at you later.